In the previous episode of Why Work, Sib Sibanda and Paul Kim kicked off the series by teasing out how the COVID pandemic altered the way we think about work. In this episode, they discuss Dorothy Sayers' first proposition and explore some of its implications.
Welcome to Reframed. Join us as we explore the concept of redemptive business in our unique context on the African continent.
Hello and welcome to part two of the Why Work podcast series based on Dorothy Sayers' essay by the same title. I'm your host, Sib Sibanda, and with me on this journey of discovery is Paul Kim. Hi, Paul. Welcome back.
Hi, Sibs. Looking forward to getting stuck into the essay.
Okay, we kicked off part one by teasing out how the COVID pandemic altered the way we think about work. And in the session, we'll be discussing the first of Sayers' three propositions and explore the first two implications thereof. The proposition is that work is not a thing one does to live, but a thing one lives to do. She goes on to say that work should be the, and I quote, full expression of the worker's faculties, the thing in which he finds spiritual, mental, and bodily satisfaction, and the medium in which he offers himself to God, end quote. From this proposition, she draws four implications, and today we'll explore the first two. The first has to do with remuneration, and the second provokes us to think about matching the work people do with their God-given abilities and passion. Let's get straight to the reading.
The question that I will ask you to consider today is this: when the war is over, are we likely and do we want to keep this attitude to work and the results of work? Or shall we want to go back to that civilization of greed and waste that we dignify by the name of a high standard of living? I'm getting very much afraid of that phrase about the standard of living, and I'm also frightened by the phrase after the war. It is so often pronounced in a tone that suggests, after the war, we want to relax and go back and live as we did before. And that means going back to the time when labor was valued in terms of its cash returns and not in terms of the work. The problem is far too simplified when it is presented as a mere conflict between labor and capital, between employed and employer. The basic difficulty remains, even when you make the state the sole employer, even when you make labor into the employer, it is not simply a question of profits and wages or living conditions, but of what is to be done with the work of the machines and what work the machines are to do. A. There is, for instance, the question of profits and remuneration. We have all got it fixed in our heads that the proper end of work is to be paid for, to produce a return in profits or payment to the worker which fully or more than compensates the effort he puts into it. What most of us demand from society is that we should always get out a little more than the value of the labor we give to it. By this process, we persuade ourselves that society is always in our debt, a conviction that not only piles up actual financial burdens, but leaves us with a grudge against society. The employer is obsessed by the notion that he must find cheap labor, and the worker by the notion that the best paid job is the job for him. Only feebly, inadequately, and spasmodically do we ever attempt to tackle the problem from the other end and inquire, what type of worker is suited to this type of work?
Okay, before we unpack this proposition, we just need to make sure it's in line with scripture. And to that end, I'll start with three quick points which are foundational to the theology of work. The first one is that God himself worked. And so the Bible opens in Genesis 1:1 with the words, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." And so the very first thing we see when the curtain of human history opens is God at work. And commenting on this verse in Every Good Endeavor, Tim Keller says, "In the beginning, then, God worked. Work was not a necessary evil that came into the picture later, or something human beings were created to do, but that was beneath the great God himself. No, God worked for the sheer joy of it. work could not have had a more exalted inauguration, end quote. Unless we think God worked in the beginning and then put his feet up, Jesus says in John 5:17, my Father is always at his work to this very day, and I too am working. So that's point one. God worked and continues to work. The second point is this. God commanded us to work. And in Genesis 1, verse 28, which is summarized by five imperatives, be fruitful, multiply, fill, subdue, and rule. Darrow Miller, commenting on this in his book Lifework, says the following. He says, when we look further into the creation narrative, we come upon a set of truths vital to rightly understanding our nature and ultimate purpose. God made humankind to be culture makers. Whatever our calling and wherever our deployment, as Christians, our work is ultimately to create kingdom culture, culture that reflects the true nature and character of God. Our charge as creators of culture has been called the creation mandate or the cultural mandate. Then the third point is the fact that Christian work is as unto the Lord. And jumping across to the New Testament, Apostle Paul says in Colossians 3:23, whatever you do, work at it with all of your heart, working for the Lord and not for men. And so with that brief overview, we can conclude that Seth's first proposition is on safe biblical ground. Work is what we were created to do, not just something we have to do for practical or other reasons.
Zips, can I just pause there quickly and just maybe riff on your second point? The God commanded us to work, be fruitful, multiply, fill, subdue, and rule. And this is like an on-the-spot kind of reflection point. Multiply, I think I mentioned in the previous episode, I've always seen that as a kind of command to have children. But if you see that command to have children in the context of works, it's actually quite fascinating, because having children or being commanded to have children does two things for us from a work perspective. It forces us to figure out how to transfer knowledge and everything that comes with the burden of that. And that in itself is a very difficult thing to get right. But also, having a growing population does force us to be innovative. It forces us to figure out how to scale in that sense of the word, to build cities and so on and so forth. So it's fascinating to just hear it again, but hear the word multiply in the context of work.
Yeah, it's very good, Paul, because we touched on that last week where we talked about the interconnectedness of the cultural mandate, of these imperatives, that they're not standalones, but they actually do work together. And you've just brought that out beautifully. And so back to this proposition that work is not something one lives to do, or beg your pardon, work is not something that one does to live, but lives to do. It is a big idea, because I think it's safe to say that most of us think of work as a necessity, something that needs to be done so we can look after ourselves and the people who depend on us. And this proposition is not denying that necessarily. It's just saying that that's not the primary reason. When we're thinking biblically, that's not the primary reason that we work. How does this challenge commonly held perspectives on work, Paul?
I think that's quite a remarkable and far out statement to make these days, just because of where the world is at in its perception of work. Work is, for many people, has got such a bad rap because of how painful it is, not just the eking out a subsistence wage for many in the world, but also many of us who are stuck in work that maybe pays well, but the drudgery of it, or the pain of the work involved, or the fact that it's just an 8-to-5 for us, we don't really find any enjoyment or meaning from the work. And so if someone says we live to work, it almost gets immediately perceived as you're a workaholic. I must admit, I'm often very cautious of saying I really enjoy my work. And it's because I think people will immediately have the negative perception of that. So to say that in this day and age, I think is, as much as it's refreshing, it is also quite daunting, because you need to substantiate that. Why are you able to say that? And I think there's two ways of looking at this. So biblically, you've laid a lot of the groundwork, Sips, But fundamentally, it boils down to, why did God create humanity? Why did God create humankind? And I think if you grew up in church circles, you more immediately come up with this Christianese answer, which is to glorify God. You may be, you know, you may elaborate that by saying something to the effect of spreading the gospel. But if you look at something like Genesis 1, you see none of that. You see, in essence, from Genesis 1, 26 to 31, the reason why God created man was to work. And so that's kind of where we need to start. Now, you've got to figure out how to express that in the right way, right? So we live with many examples of work being done incorrectly and for the wrong reasons. And so that's why work is a bad rap. And so work with God at the center and as expression of love for neighbor is the right way of seeing work. And then it starts making a lot more sense why humans were made, or the primary function of humans is to work. And then on a related note, we do have to make sense of why work is so painful. And I'm jumping ahead now, and I'm hoping we can expand on it a little bit later on. But one of the three phrases associated with the curse on work in Genesis 3 is this phrase, by the sweat of your brow, you will eat your food. For me, it's in stark contrast to what Adam and Eve had in the Garden of Eden, which was a place of abundance. It's clearly described as that. And so post the fall, post being exited out of the Garden of Eden, unfortunately, to eat requires the necessity of work. And that's what many of us are facing and experiencing. So it is real. It is there. And we have to make sense of that. We can't just say, oh, you know, that's all just in our imagination. And then for me, that is a kind of important redemptive opportunity. We always speak about what is the redemptive lens on some of the challenges that we face. And for us as Christians who believe in a God of abundance, who believe in a God that's created the world, we can start off with an abundance imagination and then build out of that in order to create abundance for others. Because the reality is, if you can't help someone move from a scarcity mindset to abundance mindset, you're just replicating or repeating what we're currently seeing in the world. That's the one perspective, to start off from a biblical perspective. But another way to kind of think through this is just from our natural experience of work as humans. Now, work can keep you busy for many hours in a day, for many days in a week, and for many weeks in a year. And there's nothing else in life that can keep you preoccupied for that same intensity without having a significant negative effect on you. Leisure, sleep, eating, watching series, student days. I think many people, if they went to varsity and stayed on campus, our generation, we binged on a lot of series, and you end up feeling really bad after watching 8 hours of series straight. If I sleep more than 8 hours a day, I feel really bad. But for some reason, I can definitely work more than 8 hours a day and feel invigorated after that. Why is that? Furthermore, nothing scratches the itch like good work. The pleasure of having done good work is distinct from any other pleasure, and combined with the intensity with which we can pursue work should be clues as to how important work is to us as humans. The remarkable thing here is the ability to reflect on our work and reflect on its goodness and to enjoy it. And it's something that's unique to us as humans and part of what it means to be made in God's image. God did that, right? After each day, he said, it is good. I don't think any other part of creation can do this. Ants do not look at the substructure that they create under the ground and think, wow, we created this incredibly complex home for us. That's amazing. Only we as humans have that ability to do that. And again, pointing to how important work is to us as humans. So if I had to clarify what Dorothy is saying, I would say the following. I'd use more words than her to elaborate. God created man in his image to co-create with him. He blesses us with raw creation, but mandates us to pursue every inch of humanness he has blessed us with, to uncover the potentialities hidden in this rawness, so as to build a beautiful tapestry of complex human civilizations that displays flourishing life for all of creation to his glory. This requires an incredible amount of work, but more importantly, work that is grounded in what it means to be made in the image of the relational and personal God. We live to work because to work like this is life-giving in God's kingdom.
That's really good stuff, Paul. And I just want to pick up on two things that you talked about. The first one related to, you were asking, if you were to ask a Christian what why were human beings created, that we might give an answer like to glorify God. And yet what we see in Genesis 1 is not those words per se. What we see is God saying, well, work. That's what I'm creating you to do. The interesting thing about that is the Hebrew word translated as work is avodah, which jointly means work, worship, and service. And I believe is used about 285 times in the Old Testament. And so the idea there is that from God's perspective, work and worship were not two separate ideas. So it wasn't this idea that we would go to work, finish our work, and then start worshiping or set aside times to worship, but that rather we would worship God, we would glorify God in and through our work. And so the concept of worship and glorifying God right there in the beginning, but it is seen through the lens of of work and expressed through our work. And the second thing I wanted to pick up on is that point on mental health, because I think that would have struck a chord with many of our listeners, because it is a growing global concern. So it's really important to mention that a theology of work is not complete without a theology of rest. The two go hand in hand, and we will explore this topic of rest further in the next session. Suffice to say for now that as much as God created us as human beings to work, he did also set a limit on work by himself resting from his work. And we see this in Genesis 2:2. And commenting on this passage, actually, Tim Keller, in his book, Every Good Endeavor, says that a proper reading of the first two chapters of Genesis should stop us from making two mistakes. The first is demonizing work, where we see work as a necessary evil rather than something we were created to do, which speaks to this first proposition. But the second, and to your point on overworking and mental health, second mistake is idolizing, where we start to look to work as our primary source of identity, of security, significance, self-worth. And the strange thing, as I just reflect on this, is that it's actually possible to fall into both traps at the same time. So on the one hand, seeing work as a necessary evil, while at the same time finding our identity and security in what we do.
Yeah, I fully agree on that. And then again, it's because of the sequence of events that unfolded because of the fall. Like we rejected God's rule, and therefore we had to take over the mantle ourselves and eke out an existence. Being chucked out of Garden Eden means that, we have to we will only eat by the sweat of our brow. And because there's a void left in what we are worshiping, because we declined to worship God, inevitably the thing that we put the most of our time and probably we take delight in becomes the idol in our life. And so we get trapped in that duality. We're doing it to work out of existence. And then at the same time, it starts to be our identity, the thing that we worship.
And just perhaps a final thought on this proposition itself before we go on to talk about the implications. If working is what we are created to do, so part of what it means to be human, this directly impacts how we think about retirement. Now, granted, the very concept of stopping work when you reach a certain age is foreign to the vast majority of Africans, but I think it is fair to say that for our generation, it's still seen as something to be aspired to. So it's probably worth mentioning that according to Sayre's proposition, which, as we've already established, is biblically sound, we should not so much be aspiring to stop working at a certain age, but rather look forward to pursuing different types of work through which perhaps we can serve society without the need for remuneration. Not so?
Yes, I think perhaps we should have, clarified at the start that the type of work that we're talking about here isn't just paid work, And if you think about it from that perspective, many of us, all of us, are probably working way more than 8 hours a day because we work to serve our families through making food, looking after them, and so on and so forth. But even in your question or your proposition around retirement, I think I still think is it doesn't go far enough. The whole retirement business is based on the wrong assumptions. If we take Sayers' essay seriously, you know, but make sure that we understand that we live in a fallen world, then what should happen is that, yes, you may start off by working for necessity, but instead of feeding a lifestyle first, rather fund the ability to do what you believe is the right work to do over time and that you're called to do. And then once you're there, to grow in that over time until the day you die. If you do it that way, there would be no stage called retirement. You would just change the amount of remuneration you could earn, and perhaps for physical demands, your role may change. But in essence, you would continue doing the work that you always did. In its current structure, we lose too many experienced individuals dropping off the retirement cliff. And as a society, we lose a lot because these are highly experienced individuals with a lot of skill set that we just... that could easily become mentors and advisors to the next generation following the wake, but we send them off into retirement because, well, that's what retirement is about. And that's just horrific for society. So in essence, what I'm trying to say is, yes, work may start off as necessity for many of us, but instead of getting started with our lifestyle and then being hooked to work as necessity, create the space to move to work as a calling before we establish what the resulting lifestyle should be. And I think many of us get the sequence wrong. We get to our 40s and then decide, oh, we need to find purpose. I think there's that famous course that you can go on called Halftime. But, you know, it's 20, 30 years later than you should have started thinking about it. And we can definitely start the journey earlier for many of us.
Right. And I think that's a good segue into the first implication that says draws from her first proposition, which has to do with remuneration, and she states it as follows. And I quote, "We have all got it fixed in our heads that the proper end of work is to be paid, to produce a return in profits or payment to the worker, which fully or more than compensates the efforts he puts into it. But if our proposition is true, this does not follow at all. So long as society provides the worker with a sufficient return in real wealth to enable him to carry on the work properly, then he has his reward. For his work is the measure of his life, and his satisfaction is found in the fulfillment of his own nature and in contemplation of the perfection of his work." End quote. Now, at face value, it may sound like she's saying that remuneration is not important, which is bound to get a reaction, I'm sure. But that's not the point she's making, is it, Paul?
No, I don't think that is the case at all. I think she's rather speaking to a right ordering of motivations. I mean, if you go to scripture, it's quite clear that reward for work is important. Even if you look at something like gleaning, by taking away someone's ability to work for themselves, you're also robbing them at the same time of getting rewarded for their work. Those two go hand in hand. And to use charity instead of gleaning where possible is to rob people of a core part of what it means to be human, to work, and then to be rewarded for one's work. I think the point she's trying to make is that the purpose of work is not primarily for remuneration. And the reason why this is so difficult for us to consider is because it is so entrenched in our thinking. And this happens, and it's happened for a number of different reasons. I think, you know, we've spoken about capitalism in the Monday Christian podcast. It's done wonders for the world, but it's also done a lot of bad because it's based on this key pillar of self-interest. And so then work is more about what I can get out of it more than anything else. Consumerism, the entire advertising and marketing machines of this world constantly pushing us to buy more. I mean, how many adverts do you see about the importance of work versus the adverts about buying the Porsche to enjoy your life? It's just the amount of media that we expose to is just pushing us to thinking more about our lifestyle than about the importance of our work. And then the vacuum that's created by the drudgery and pain of work. Many of us are stuck in work that's just not enjoyable, unfortunately, and therefore you seek your pleasure elsewhere. And so, you know, that's kind of why it's so entrenched at this point in time. But furthermore, remuneration is interesting because I think very few of us do it just for the money. It's what the money promises. It's what the remuneration enables, the lifestyle that it affords them, the future scenarios that are enabled by remuneration. So idea of working hard without the promise or at least the hope of my desired lifestyle for me and my family seems strange and even a bit ridiculous.
Yeah, it does. It does. And but let's take time now to apply that same litmus test to ourselves, right? Because we both have a good idea of the lifestyle we'd either like to achieve or sustain. I think, you know, from time to time, my wife and I will sit and talk, maybe when we're taking a walk or, you know, a lazy Sunday afternoon and pottering about and just talk about some of the aspirations that we have, you know, maybe for work on the house or places we'd like to visit or things we'd like to do. And all of that, of course, is can only be facilitated by remuneration from the work that we do. And so my question to you would be, would you be content to work without at least a reasonable hope of achieving and or sustaining that lifestyle that perhaps you and Jill?
Yeah, and this is where the rubber hits the road, right? Because we talk theory, we talk implications, but you know, how does this actually apply in our lives? And you know, I have 15, 16 years of work behind me, and so you know, all I can do is share the challenges that I've been through as I've wrestled through this question. I've been foolish enough for most of my career to have followed my entrepreneurial desire inclinations, and I've never really felt that I was remunerated enough. Particularly because I chose ventures that were difficult. And when you start your own business, it doesn't matter how much you work, doesn't matter how great your product is. None of that matters if you don't have clients that pay. And so, you know, the reward ultimately can be nothing if your ventures don't succeed. Having said that, about 4 or 5 years into my entrepreneurial journey, I had this desire to want to work and to be able to work on things that I thought mattered. And then, you know, that coincided with what I was reading at that time. Tim Keller's Every Good Endeavor came out. And so we made a decision to live within our means in order to preserve my ability to work on what I think I was called to work on. And so that meant a frugal lifestyle with a lot of margin, a lot of saving to ensure that I was never forced to make a decision about work because we didn't have enough money to do A, B, C, and D. And so we've been doing that for 13 and 14 years, and it's been a fascinating journey. And so where I've landed up with that is I think God blesses us with both the work that we've been given to, and he blesses us with the remuneration he gives us. And we're going to be accountable for both independently. So the work he's given us, did we do it well? Did we do it out of obedience to God? Did we do it for his glory? And then the remuneration we've received, did we look after our family with it? Were we generous with it? Did we deploy it into the rest of society as if it was God doing it himself? And then it becomes a fascinating conversation as we reflect on that. So it doesn't mean that we don't get to enjoy the fruits of our labor, but it does mean that I take account of all the dimensions of responsibility God has given me and blessed me with before I consider my lifestyle at the front and center of my decision making.
That's very interesting, Paul. And as I was listening to you, the word lifestyle kept coming up, which is good because I had it in my question that I posed. And I think it is an interesting one because, just to give you a bit of background to our listeners, I was born in Zim and was raised here and studied engineering, but then went into full-time ministry pretty much straight after university and did that for about 20 years. And the last sort of 11 of those were in Johannesburg. And then we moved back to Zim about 2.5 years ago. And on this question of lifestyle, what I found in moving back to Harare from Johannesburg was that the expectations of the kind of lifestyle that I wanted and maybe my wife and I wanted was different when we moved back to Harare. So when we were in Joburg, there was a certain drive to attain a lot of stuff. So we were kind of almost swallowed up in this consumerist society and not even society, but a spirit. And when we moved back to Zim, It's not that we stopped wanting stuff, but there was almost a simplicity in our desires. And so I think there's a lot to be said for thinking through what is shaping the idea of the kind of lifestyle that we're looking for in the first place. So that's something I think for all of us to think about. But then also something else you said, you talked about how, you know, if I've worked hard and the remuneration is mine. And I think that's where, again, we brush up against the sort of theological idea of stewardship versus ownership, right? So even if I've worked for something, understanding that whatever I have, I'm stewarding. And it's not to say I can't buy a nice car or go on a nice holiday, but the point that you did bring up earlier was that we have to be accountable. So even as we think through how we spend the money we've worked for, we're thinking, this is God's money, Lord, how would you want me to use it? But still also thinking through, I have to be accountable to that.
Yeah, I love those two points you raised. Just on the first quickly, it's so subtle though, hey? I, as you were mentioning that, I remember there was a church event that we had to go to, a picnic. And I think it was in Bring and Share. And I just felt like, yo, if I rock up with anything branded from Pick and Pay or Checkers, it's not good enough. I have to get something from Woolies, right? And it's as subtle as that. And it's just remarkable how it infects your view of the world and what you think is normal. And then to your second point, I think, you know, if we had to phrase it simplistically, because there are no hard and fast rules about this, right? Because we don't want to be legalistic. As you become wealthier and wiser, if you're not growing to be more outward-centered, but you're rather growing to be more inward-centered, there's some red lights that must go off. You know, if you, Jill's uncle mentioned the reason why he didn't buy a boat, I mean, he's got the money, is because then you have to worry about it. You know, are you using it enough? Are you going out enough? You have to repair and maintenance. It just becomes now another thing that you have to worry about. And that can easily become a major thing for us who are relatively wealthy. We're just buying more things that we have to maintain and worry about, and that becomes insular. But as we become wealthier in God's kingdom, it should be the ability to be more outward focused, whatever that means, generosity, hospitality, looking after the poor, seeking to be more risk-seeking with your businesses to make real societal change. All of those are real blessings, but we throw them away because we get stuck in this consumeristic lifestyle that the world has sold. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah, well said. Okay, let's move on now to the second implication that says offers by way of expanding on a first proposition. And here she challenges the idea that kind of work we do should be driven primarily by economic factors rather than our suitability for the work. In other words, we should think more about matching the work people do to their God-given talents and passion. She states this implication as follows, and I quote, "Employers look to pay as little as possible for good workers, and workers look to earn as much as possible for good work. Not much attention is paid to what work people are best suited for. Economic and social pressure take the lead in determining what work people do. As such, many never do the work best suited to them," end quote. So where conventional wisdom would say, choose your work based on how much you can earn, the biblical perspective of work as a divine calling suggests that as far as possible, perhaps, our work should flow from the faithful stewardship of the talents and passions that God has given us, not primarily from how much we stand to earn. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, Sips, again, this is another critical consideration for how we choose our work and one that's often neglected. So I want to tackle this from two angles. One, kind of like, what is the foundational truth for something like this? And then what are the challenges? What is the challenge that we run into when we try and apply it? So if God created us, each of us, to be unique, and a logical conclusion from that must be that we have different strengths and weaknesses and callings, then to use something like remuneration as a primary decision-making tool for choosing our work means that the workers with the most potential end up in jobs that are typically extractionary in this modern day and age. With that, what I mean is that by going after remuneration as our primary decision making, we implicitly assume that what the world deems as important is right. And that obviously is incorrect, but we just willy-nilly go after that. That's why we have too many doctors, lawyers, and so on and so forth in society there. Too many people with academic university qualifications, but not in, you know, there's not enough work for them because the real drivers of the economy are elsewhere, but no one wants to do the work because, again, remuneration is the key decision maker. Having said that, though, the world is kind of moving in the right direction, I think. The Strength Finder movement, which is relatively new, kind of moving to your strengths, has done a lot of that. But still, I think, unfortunately, remuneration is too important for our decision making. And that is an indictment on the world as much as it is an indictment on personal decision making. It is so unfair that we live in a society in a country like South Africa where teachers are so underpaid. I use teachers because if you contrast to other countries, many other countries see teaching as a noble profession where it's where teachers are paid well. But here, we don't see the teachers as a noble profession. We pay them very little, and yet they're the ones that are supposed to raise the next generation of youth to become active citizens along with their parents. And yet we are paying them so little, therefore we cannot attract the brightest minds into this space. So there's definitely something wrong with society as well in terms of the way we remunerate certain jobs. But the last thing I wanted to mention on this is, even with all of that said, I think if you're a Christian, we must also remember that a lot of our giftings or passions emerge from the way we were brought up, the particular circumstances of the way we were brought up. And that it doesn't, it is not a definitive conclusion as to what our real giftings and passions may be. And often God reveals that as we push into need, as we push into the problems of this world, he blesses us with gifts and passions and talents that we never thought were ours, but come out because we respond in obedience to God. And that is the story of my own life. I think I've mentioned it before. You know, I was good at maths, Korean. I wanted to make some money, profession. And so you put the two together, you get to becoming an actuary. But the reality is the last 14 years of my career have been more focused on people management and words.
You make an interesting point on how our perceived gifts and talents are sometimes the result of a superficial cultivation by our parents mostly. And that's an interesting one when seen from a Black African perspective, because for the most part, my parents' generation didn't give much thought to cultivating your gifts. Their emphasis was on you working towards respectable, stable, well-paying professions such as medicine, engineering, accounts, etc., regardless of what your talents or where your talents or passion lay. And my wife is a classic example because about 7 years ago, you know, we were in ministry, couldn't afford to pay for her to study. And so her parents jumped in and said, hey, you know what? We'll pay for you to study. And so they said to her, find a degree that you want to study, and we'll pay for that. So she did, and she said, okay, I found one. It's a degree in interior design. You say that to African parents, you know, the response is predictable. You know, they said, that's not a proper degree. You know, do something sensible, like social. So there are social workers in the UK, as many Zimbabweans are, so the social workers, nurses, etc., which has been great, by the way, for sustaining people who are still in Zim. So I'm not looking down on that at all. But they said, now that's a proper degree. That's a stable degree. That is sensible. And because they were paying, she went on this journey for about 6 years. She studied social work. She got a degree. And even now, having moved back to Zim, she's been working in that field. But It's been killing her slowly because that's not her passion. And only now, 6 years down the track, after having that conversation, are we in a place where she can start venturing into the thing that she's passionate about, which is interior design. So many people are suffocating their God-given talents at the altar of job security. And yes, I do recognize that for most people around the world, and certainly in Africa, people just don't have the luxury of choice when it comes to work. Basically work to survive. And with that in mind, it's best to think of these implications that we're talking about. You know, you said we're not giving rules here. That's important because these aren't rules, but perhaps guidelines for Christians in thinking about work. And here's an example of how it might play out. So if you're in the category of those who don't have the luxury of choice, and so you're working because that's the job you found and you need to feed yourself and your family or whatever the case may be, then I'd say to you from scripture, Colossians 3, verse 23, work wholeheartedly as unto the Lord. Don't be upset that you're not doing the work that you'd like to be doing, but do that work that God has given you as unto him. But also be creative within your present workspace as much as your work environment allows. And then I'd also recommend finding other outlets for your gifts. So maybe you can't fully express yourself within your work context, but find other contexts, maybe voluntary contexts where you can express those gifts. But I think the challenge is really for those of us who do have the luxury of choice. And I think that the onus is on us to see it as our responsibility to create space and margin for others to also have some degree of luxury of choice in order for them to flourish in the work that best suits them. And then also, if you do have the luxury of choice, Proverbs 3, 4 to 6 is a good one. Trust in the Lord, lean not on your own understanding. So don't get trapped into worldly thinking. Like you were saying earlier, Paul, that we tend to think that the way things are done is the right way. But actually take time to ask God, what would you have me do? Don't just do stuff because that's the in thing or that's what's going to make you most money. Do take time to think through how the Lord would want you to steward your gift. And Paul, before we conclude this session, do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, I love how you ended that with some practical guidelines. And I'd like to add one or two to each. So for those of us who don't have the luxury of choice, I want to add for us in those situations to be open to new giftings, as opposed to thinking that we have certain gifts and finding another place to explore them. But also B, I think some Asian cultures have gotten this right. I think we don't appreciate that with every work given to us, there's almost infinite depth at specialization and getting better at it. Don't just think because you are doing a menial job that there isn't depth to that. Really explore that while God has asked you to be responsible for that. And then in terms of those of us who have the luxury of choice, I actually want to maybe push back a little to your underlying assumption there. So I think the point isn't to start off with what you think your talents and gifts are, but rather to start off by, you know, who has God called you to love? That is the starting point, because anything else, starting off with what do I have, already then returns us to the assumption that I at the center. And we should rather start off with God and love of neighbor for the center and then flow from there. I think I've mentioned in one of our previous episodes on the Monday Christian podcast, the framework that I've come across that's been really helpful in this regard is, who has God called me to love? How has he called me to love them? What is required to love them that way? And then what do I have and what do I still need? And that for me kind of centers ourselves correctly on the greatest command, to, you know, love God with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love neighbor for ourselves. So yeah, really cool beginning to the essay. Dorothy's point, if the world started thinking this way, we would see a complete upheaval of how society and the economy operates.
Yeah, words to live by. And I would agree with your pushback. I think another way to look at it is, so looking at who am I called to love is one way. I think also looking at where is the brokenness in society that God has called me to address, which may actually lead you to the people, because we're not often aware of the people that God has called us to. Okay, Paul, that's a wrap for today. We've said a lot. I think this is going to be a longer session, but I think a lot of good ideas and thoughts have come out of that. Just a quick reminder to our listeners, we'd love for you to join in the conversation by dropping me an email with your comments and questions to sibs@mergon.co.za. Towards the end of the series, we're going to invite a couple of you to join us on this podcast and share your thoughts. Thank you for listening in. We'll catch you in the next session, where we'll continue to explore the implications of SER's first proposition. God bless.
Thank you for joining us. This episode of Reframed was brought to you by Ziwani, a community of business leaders who partner together to live out their kingdom calling in the marketplace within Africa. Ziwani is a Mergon initiative. To know more about us, visit our website at ziwani.com. That's ZIWANI.com.